You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll untangle Wisconsin's minimum markup law for gasoline and how it affects the prices you pay at the pump. First, a couple is suing a New Jersey fertility center for what appears to be a major mistake. Drew Wazalewski and Christina Ketterich say they turned to the clinic because they were having trouble getting pregnant. After in vitro fertilization, Christina gave birth in 2013. Around the time their daughter was two, the couple noticed she didn't look like Drew. A DNA test showed the girl was only related to Christina. The now divorced couple is seeking monetary damages and information on who the girl's biological father is. They were interviewed last week on CBS This Morning.
Drew, are you concerned that you may have biological children out there?
Yes. Yes, very much so.
How does that weigh on you?
A lot. If I have other children, you know, I want to know who I am.
It's just one of many high-profile scandals in America's largely unregulated fertility industry. Naomi Kahn is the Harold H. Green Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School. She's written several books, including Test Tube Families, Why the Fertility Market Needs Legal Regulation. She recently co-wrote an opinion piece in USA Today about the problems facing the fertility industry. Naomi, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Well, we referenced just this one case. There are many others, it seems like, out in the news these days about things going wrong in the fertility industry. Can you round up some of what we're seeing out there?
Sure, I can round up some of them. But each week, if not each day, we seem to be hearing new stories. There was just a recent report in the Washington Post about a donor who had donated to a number of families, and it turns out that a number of the children are somewhere on the autism spectrum, and there was no way of finding that out before the sperm was donated. There's another case that was the subject of our USA Today piece, which involved a mix-up in which, just as in the New Jersey case, the wrong embryo seemed to have been implanted in a woman. In that case, in the Carlon case, Ohio case, what happened was the daughter gave her entire family a DNA test for Christmas last year. They all took the DNA test only to discover that the man who had fathered this woman in her mid-20s all of her life was not her biological father. So we are hearing about an increasing number of these cases as genetic testing becomes more sophisticated.
In that piece in the USA Today, you say there's a common problem among a lot of these cases that there isn't enough oversight, especially at the federal level. What is the state of the of affairs? Is it the Wild West, basically?
It's totally the Wild West. That's the metaphor that many of us who talk about this at least those outside of the fertility industry, those of us use when we're talking about the lack of regulation. The requirements that exist, first of all, we actually have no idea how many children are born each year through sperm donation. So, and there are no limits on how many children can be born through one sperm donor. So, for example, there could be one sperm donor who goes to, I don't know, 20 different clinics, donates to each of them. And there could be multiple children. And in fact, there are cases where as many as 400, 500, or 600 children have been born from the same donor. So that could lead to a bunch of different problems, including, as I've already mentioned, this case reported in the Washington Post where a number of children were born with similarities with respect to autism. So that's one issue, is there's no regulation to know how many children are born through sperm. We do have some idea of how many children are born through egg donation, because the federal government does have a procedure in place that requires clinics to report on that. So we do know that. But those eggs, that sperm, they are not tested for genetic diseases. They are only tested for sexually transmitted diseases. So we have no idea what genetically transmitted diseases might be floating around. And then there's no follow-up. So years later, if health problems develop with the donor, there are no ways of tracking just what those health problems might be. And as I said, we just don't know how many children there are who are born through sperm donation.
And some of the creepier stories involve it being found out that the, say, a donor had been selected, but it turns out the donor ended up being a doctor or other staffer at a fertility clinic itself.
Oh, absolutely. More and more cases. One of the most famous cases, I mean, 1992, there was a case, Dr. Cecil Jacobson, and I'm based in the D.C. area, so in Virginia, who faced criminal charges because he had used his own sperm. Turns out perhaps the first known case in the United States that involved sperm donation was in the late 19th century, where a woman was chloroformed, was knocked out, and the doctor who was performing the insemination, the woman thought she was being inseminated with her husband's sperm. Turns out the doctor performing the insemination looked at all of the medical students gathered around. They decided who was the most attractive medical student, and it was that man who donated his sperm to that woman. It's not even clear that she even knew that it was not her husband's sperm that had been used. So physicians, doctors using their own sperm to inseminate without the woman or the couple knowing goes back more than 100 years.
Talking to Naomi Kahn, professor at the George Washington University School of Law, looking at the what many call Wild West of the fertility industry in the United States. Naomi, how big an industry is this?
This is it's hard to know because we don't really track it, but I've seen estimates, quite credible estimates, of $2 to $3 billion. Now, I do also want to say that this doesn't mean that everyone should suddenly go out and not trust fertility doctors. Most fertility clinics are highly reputable, do follow industry standards, do what they can in terms of testing, do provide informed consent. So I don't want to lose sight of the fact that many people are able to have children that they would not otherwise be able to have through the fertility industry. It's just that the lack of regulation means that we're going to be finding some problems that crop up that could be solved with additional regulation. But the fertility industry itself provides incredible hope, incredible support for probably close to 10% of all people of reproductive age. So it's just because there are these cases that we're hearing about, just because there's this lack of regulation, does not mean that the fertility industry does not provide an enormous amount of good.
We've seen some states tackle regulations, I think Texas, Indiana, California. Is this something that can be solved state by state?
As you note, a few states have developed laws on fertility fraud. So they've criminalized, for example, the use of a doctor's own sperm for insemination. I think that says if you are caught, then you may be penalized. But it doesn't really help the families who suddenly find out, oh my gosh, I am not, or the child I thought I was genetically related to is not my child. I was told something different by the fertility clinic. So it doesn't really help the families. I think it is an issue where, because there are people with fertility problems who live in every single state in this country, that it's something that needs to be done on the federal level. It's helpful to have states moving forward. They can help provide an example for what the federal government should do. But we do need federal regulations. Federal regulations also means that if somebody donates in Wisconsin, that if that person then goes, for example, to, I don't know, my home state of Missouri, that we know who that person is and we can track that donor. Because donors can very easily cross state lines. Children can be, donor sperm and eggs are sent around the country. And so we need national regulation that will deal with all, that will deal with the donated sperm and eggs wherever they are.
You've written that the British might be a good model for us to turn to for fertility regulation. What do you see them doing right?
They have a national system. They limit the number of children. I'm sorry, they limit the number of families that can use any particular donor. They don't limit the number of children. So if one family wanted to have 10 children, that would be perfectly fine. But they do limit the number. So there are limits on the number of families who can use any individual donor, and there is a national registry. They also provide that donor conceived offspring will be able to find out the identity of their donors when the offspring reach the age of 18. So it's something that will help that many donor conceived offspring want, of course, not all of them, but it's a situation in which donors know that their identities may be disclosed. What we have in the United States is that even if donors are promised anonymity, with the rise of genetic testing, it's possible to track down all kinds of relatives. So what they have is a national system of regulation that keeps track of the number of children born per donor, and that also keeps track of the testing of the donor sperm and eggs, and that ensures that donor-conceived offspring can find out the identity of their donors.
Naomi, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Naomi Kahn is a professor at the George Washington University School of Law. We talked to her about recent problems in the U.S. fertility industry and her call for that industry to be regulated by the federal government. Coming up, we'll talk about research out of UW-Eau Claire that looks at how Wisconsin's minimum markup law affects gas prices around the state. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump's former campaign manager had some tense exchanges with lawmakers yesterday at a hearing related to potential obstruction of justice by the president. We'll check out that story and more in our look at the week in Washington. First, Wisconsin's minimum markup law was in the news this year when Governor Tony Evers proposed getting rid of it as part of his roads and infrastructure spending plan. Evers' proposal was paired with a gas tax hike and was later stripped from the budget by the Republican-controlled legislature. In the Eau Claire area, the minimum markup law and its effect on gas prices had been the subject of attention years before. Ryan Weichelt is an associate professor of geography at UW-Eau Claire. He recently wrote about this in a piece titled "The Stubborn Similarity of Gas Prices Across Eau Claire." You can find that online at wiscontext.org. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, remind us, what is Wisconsin's minimum markup law? What does it do?
It's a very complex law with a lot of different pieces associated with it. But in the general sense, it sets certain levels that retailers can mark up various goods for between 6% and 9%, depending on things that are happening. Usually it's attached to gas prices, grocery store stuff. Our study focused specifically on gas prices.
Why do we have this in Wisconsin?
Well, so this law goes back to the Great Depression era. I think it was passed in 1939, and it was meant to protect, you can use the term mom-and-pa stores, from being taken over by big, you know, commercial retailers that can certainly drive the price down and try to, you know, push these little guys out.
And now you tried to assess how this impacts gas prices in Wisconsin, and you did that through the lens of your backyard there, Eau Claire. But there's kind of a political story that kind of drove this with a local politician. Can you bring us there?
Yeah, before I came to Eau Claire, I came to Eau Claire in 2009, there's always been this discussion, I guess, that the price of gasoline in Eau Claire was always much higher than places around that. And so there was a whole bunch of wild theories attached to that. But at one point, by 2011, he's a late city council member, Dave Duax, had asked the state of Wisconsin's Department of Justice to come investigate price-fixing allegations because he always thought of the price of gasoline being so high in Eau Claire. The DOJ came in pretty quickly, found that there was actually no evidence to suggest that these guys were colluding with one another. There are these stories. There are people in back rooms cutting deals. Other people had called me, said there was death threats if any of this information ever to be leaked out. I came in as a geographer and was really interested in that geography had to play some sort of role in this particular one. So I actually contacted Dave Duax and said, we're willing to do a study on this in Eau Claire. And the results came out in 2012.
Now, talk to us about what you found out about the price of gas. Was it really higher in Eau Claire than other areas nearby in Wisconsin or across the borders?
It actually was a bit higher, not a whole lot higher, but it was different. Prices are different. Now, the minimum markup law is kind of interesting in the state, is that there are some exceptions associated with this. So I know down in Milwaukee area, they do different types of blending for their gases, so their gas is a different price. They do give exceptions for prices of gasolines along, say, the border of Minnesota, so those gas stations can compete with Minnesota. But Eau Claire's price actually was a bit higher compared to other cities like Menominee, which is only 20 minutes away, Marshfield, Wausau, and those particular things, but just a few cents higher.
Now, the idea here with minimum markup is if Ryan's gas station is charging X amount for gas, I can't come in and open Rob's gas station and undercut you to try to drive you out of business. But weirdly, it seems like it affects communities in different ways when it comes to the price, but also the variation of prices you discovered.
Yeah, I mean, we found out pretty quickly. One of the more surprising concepts when my students actually kind of figured out when he was engaging in this was, we were looking at the distance of gas stations to other gas stations. Generally, you're going to see a lot more gas stations kind of piled up along the freeways because, you know, they're trying to catch people going back and forth. But we found in Eau Claire especially, the distance between gas stations that weren't along the highways wasn't that far. And the price of gasoline was exactly the same throughout the entire city. So, you know, the minimum markup law created that in that there was no incentive for me as a consumer to drive across town because gas is 10 cents cheaper over there. So the price is the same, and therefore the stations are like, well, we're just going to put stuff in where we might be able to, you know, take advantage of people buying groceries or those particular types of things. So it creates a system that the gas stations in Wisconsin, specifically the studies we looked at, were very equally distributed compared to other states, and therefore because of the markup then, the price was basically exactly the same.
And you looked at some of our neighbors, I think including Minnesota and Iowa, and check mm-hmm. me on this, they don't have minimum markup laws there?
I know Iowa doesn't. Minnesota has, and I'm not an expert on Minnesota law, they have a somewhat variation of the minimum markup law, but it's not as strict on the gasoline side of things. And so you're going to see in Minnesota a higher price variation between gas stations. You could, if you go over the cities, you might see one is 15 to 20 cents cheaper in one spot compared to someplace else. Iowa, sometimes it can swing 30 cents between those different places. In Wisconsin, you're just not going to see that in any given city.
Okay, there's more variation there, but do we know, do they pay less or more or the same on average as we do here in Wisconsin?
I guess it depends on the city you're sort of looking at.
It's complicated.
It is complicated. We pay higher taxes in Wisconsin. Our gas tax is a bit higher compared to Minnesota. I think our gas tax is about almost 33 cents. Minnesota's 28 cents. Iowa's is 30 cents. But depending on market conditions and all those things sort of kick in, gasoline prices in Wisconsin tend to be a bit higher than those particular neighbors. And that markup law is meant to do that, to mark the price up to give everyone a competing advantage.
Talking to Ryan Weichelt from UW-Eau Claire, talking about Wisconsin's minimum markup law as it applies to gasoline and how it actually affects gas prices here in the state. Now, you looked into some of the specifics of competition. You know, there are the places we think of as long-running gas stations, and we have Quick Trip on the market. But also you saw Fleet Farm and Woodman's getting into the game for maybe their own reasons. So how do the different types of competitors here change things?
Yeah, so when our study was being done, there was no Woodman's, there was no Fleet Farm at that particular time. We found that at that time it was the Holiday Stations and Quick Trip were the main dominant companies in the Eau Claire market. Actually, in the city of Eau Claire, because of this study, they wouldn't let any new gas stations come in unless they were a different one. So Quick Trip tried to build a station in Eau Claire, and the city council kind of cited our study and said no. Now, what they did is they went right over to Altoona, which is right on the border of Eau Claire. And
right, you can't really notice that you've gone into Altoona yeah. from Eau Claire at some
exactly.
points. Yeah.
Exactly. So they just kind of moved over there, and then when Woodman's came in, they sort of disrupted the market a little bit. The FTC has called places like Woodman's and Fleet Farm, Walmart does this, they call them hypermarkets. They're not so concerned about selling gasoline. They're trying to get people to come into their stores. And so Woodman's was the first one. They dropped the price down as low as they possibly could. And at that time, it was about 10 cents different compared to everything else. And, you know, it was trying to draw people into their stores to buy groceries. And, hey, you know what? Their gas is 10 cents cheaper. I might as well get the gas over in there. Fleet Farm in 2018 was the first gas station to be built in the city of Eau Claire. And what we see on the map now is sort of effect of Woodman's and Fleet Farm is the gas stations in right in the immediate geographic area are 5 cents cheaper. And then you get away from about a mile, then they go up 5 cents. So there's a little more variation in the Eau Claire's gas market than there used to be, but it's only about 5 cents.
So the intent of minimum markup laws on gas and, like you said, other stuff was to keep smaller local, like you said, mom and pop businesses in business. I don't know if your studies have gone here, but did it work? Did it keep smaller businesses in place?
Well, you can start seeing it in maybe northern Wisconsin. You don't see the impacts maybe of the Quick Trips and Holidays. But Quick Trip has done a really good job, and this isn't the pick on Quick Trip at all. They've sort of figured out how the market works, and they've really expanded over the last, especially 2 years or so, really trying to get into these different types of markets. Is it driving out the little gas stations? Our study didn't look into that, but I think what it's done is it's sort of protected those types of industries. And the little gas stations, it's really hard, I think, if you and I wanted to start a gas station tomorrow, unless we had some of that capital behind us, offering things like groceries and those things. Those are what drawing people into the new gas stations.
All right. On a personal level, Ryan, knowing what you know about the variety of gas prices, do you ever drive 5 miles out of your way to save that 5 cents a gallon?
Well, if you go to Fleet Farm and you buy a pack of gum, they give you 3 cents off. So every once in a while, I will go about, I only live a few miles away, and I'll drive the extra thing to get my 5 cents off, certainly.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you so much.
That was Ryan Weichelt, Associate Professor of Geography at UW-Eau Claire. He was with us today to talk about Wisconsin's minimum markup law and how it affects gas prices around the state. You can read more about it in his article online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, top Democrats in Congress are divided over impeaching President Trump. We'll talk about that and more in our look at the week in Washington. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a state agency is considering updates to Wisconsin's livestock siting rules, and some major farm groups say the changes could be disastrous for them. We'll hear a perspective from a group representing the state's dairy industry. First, we take a look at the week in Washington. President Trump's former campaign manager showed up for a tense hearing with the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. The White House is putting new sanctions on Iran after the bombing of Saudi oil facilities. And some top House Democrats are divided over whether to launch impeachment proceedings against President Trump. Our question for you this week, do you think Democrats in the House should consider impeachment? If you're a Democratic voter, do you like this idea, or do you think the election next year needs more of the focus? Is there something you'd like Congress to focus on instead of impeachment? If you support the president, what do you make of this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Heather Cagle is a congressional reporter for Politico. She joins us from the U.S. Capitol building. Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, let's talk about the testimony of President Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. What were Democrats hoping to get out of this? Why did they call him to testify?
Well, I think for Democrats, since the Mueller report came out in late April, the whole goal was to get as many eyewitnesses who testified to Mueller and gave accounts that were in the report to get those folks up on the Hill, have them recount their stories, essentially, you know, so the public could see these folks say it in their own words and put it on TV and things like that. Democrats have really struggled with that because the White House has basically claimed immunity for all of the aides mentioned in the report and flat out refused to allow them to testify. And there's some legal argument over whether they're allowed to do that. And that's what Democrats are working through the courts to do. But Lewandowski was the first eyewitness to testify before the House from the Mueller report. It came out in April. Here we are in September, and this is their first real hearing. So I think they were looking to bring the report to life through him. And of course, yesterday he tried to do everything that he could to dismiss their questions and not answer them. And so that's what we saw, that tense back and forth yesterday for several hours.
It was an awkward event. Here's a bit of an exchange between Corey Lewandowski and Committee Chair Gerald Nadler.
How many times did he direct you to deliver a message to a member of his cabinet?
The White House's director had not disclosed the substance of any discussions with the president.
Did he ever discuss with you any concerns that he may have committed a criminal offense?
The White House's director had not disclosed the substance of any discussions with the president or his advisors to protect executive branch confidentiality.
Now, a weird thing there is Corey Lewandowski was never part of the executive branch. He was part of the Trump campaign. So that is one of the big legal questions you were just referencing there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Lewandowski never worked in the White House. And so Democrats argue you can't even claim executive privilege over someone who never worked under you officially and prevent them from answering questions. But that's exactly what we saw yesterday. I mean, we just heard Lewandowski's response to several of Democrats' questions. It was, as you played, the White House instructed me not to answer this. Not only that, but there were two White House lawyers sitting behind him who he frequently consulted with. And that enraged Democrats, given, again, that Lewandowski never actually worked for the Trump White House. He only worked for the campaign.
Now, at some point, Lewandowski did acknowledge, it sounds like, that President Trump had directed him to deliver a message to then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions, asking Sessions to deliver a message that he's going to limit the scope of the Mueller report. That was something that confirmed the Mueller report and what had been attributed to Lewandowski, right?
Yeah, and I think, so Lewandowski never actually delivered the message to Sessions, right? He said yesterday, I quote-unquote went on vacation. But he did confirm that the president did ask him to deliver this message to limit the scope of the Mueller report. And I think for Democrats who walked away from this hearing yesterday feeling mostly very deflated, they felt like this was the one victory that they got out of it. And remember, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee has repeatedly said that they are in an impeachment investigation. He said earlier this week he thinks that Trump should be impeached. That was Congressman Nadler's strongest declaration on this issue so far. And so he and others on the committee billed this as the first quote-unquote official impeachment hearing. Now, you talk to some in Democratic leadership, Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office, for instance, and they will disagree with that, and that obviously is a whole other issue. But I think for Democrats on the committee, it was important, even if Lewandowski's performance was mostly disappointing to them, to have him make this point of confirming this episode in the Mueller report and just having him appear before the committee and continue, in their mind, to prove the point that the White House is doing all it can to obstruct their investigation into potential wrongdoings.
Talking to Heather Cagle, congressional reporter for Politico. We're talking about some of the week's top stories in national news. Well, let's follow up on that impeachment division within the Democratic House delegation. Heather, what are we seeing between Speaker Nancy Pelosi and people like Gerald Nadler and people who are going even further in their calls for impeachment?
You know, we wrote a story about this morning, actually, the different paths that Speaker Pelosi and Chairman Nadler are on publicly about what the House is actually doing and where this goes. And we keep seeing these paths get wider and wider and their messages get more different. And that's confusing to the rank and file members when they go back home and voters say, well, are you guys in an impeachment investigation? What's going on? And you have, you know, the Speaker of the House saying one thing, and you have the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, which would oversee, you know, articles of impeachment, saying a different thing. And so the point that we tried to make this morning is that at some point, Pelosi and Nadler have mostly been talking past each other. They have not directly criticized the other one, and they have not had a confrontation about their differing viewpoints. But at some point within the next few months, they are going to have a very serious discussion, because Nadler has said he has an informal year-end deadline for when he wants to decide whether his committee should draft articles of impeachment, vote on those in the committee to recommend them to the full House. Now, Pelosi runs a very top-down approach in the House. She always has. She's long time led the Democratic caucus, almost two decades at this point. And so she would sign off on that even if they did draft it in committee. And she still does not support the idea of impeachment. She keeps, you know, repeatedly pointing to public polling, which has about 30-ish percent of voters support the idea. So it's a huge percent that don't want to see the president impeached. And she repeatedly says, until that number ticks up dramatically, I don't think we should do this. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have Nadler saying, I think we have enough to impeach the president. I think he should be impeached. So at some point in the next couple of months, they're going to have to figure out how to reconcile those very different viewpoints to decide what the House does next and how they act, if they act at all.
Bring on a caller on the issue of impeachment at 800-642-1234. Scott joins us in Windsor. Scott, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I couldn't, you know, I can't emphasize enough the importance of impeaching this guy and his administration. This is an abuse of our Constitution and our system of checks and balances, and it's becoming more and more blatant every day, the lawlessness of this administration. And the fact that the Democrats can't seem to get on the same page and recognize that circumstance is absolutely, as a Democratic Party, a member of the Democratic Party, is absolutely maddening.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. What are some of the issues that Democrats are talking about as things that might be in articles of impeachment, if and when those exist, Heather?
Well, so they point to the Mueller report, where Mueller laid out 10 episodes where his investigators allege that Trump tried to obstruct justice by somehow blocking the investigation or trying to cut it off, all those things. So obstruction of justice would be one of those, right? And then there's a lot of investigations on the Hill, on the House side, of course, into potential corruption in the administration, corruption with the Trump organization, conflicts of interest. Is President Trump profiting from his businesses, from foreign countries, you know, doing business with him, or staying in his hotels, things like that, while he's president? And then, you know, the third article that gets mentioned often and was mentioned yesterday particularly is obstructing Congress. That was an article of impeachment in the Nixon impeachment process. And they said that Lewandowski's refusal, despite not working for the White House, to answer their questions and claim, you know, executive privilege, just shows further that Trump's White House is determined to obstruct Congress. And so those are basically the three that they talk about: obstruction of justice, obstruction of Congress, and overall corruption related to President Trump.
We're talking to Heather Cagle from Politico about the week's news in national politics. You can still join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on some Democrats, many in the House, considering impeaching the president, though House Speaker Nancy Pelosi not there yet anyway? If you tend to vote Democratic, do you think it is something the party should pursue? If you are a Republican or a supporter of President Trump, what do you think should happen? What do you think will happen if the Democrats try to impeach the president? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Heather Cagle, congressional reporter for Politico, looking at some of the week's top stories from the nation's capital. We invited your calls at 800-642-1234 on this idea of impeachment. Should House Democrats pursue impeachment of President Trump? We'll go now to Jackie with us in Milwaukee. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I'm Rob Ferret. read a very good article a couple of days ago on impeachment, which I definitely would like to see, that if they focus on the Mueller report, it'll inflame the base. There's so much that's been contested already. If they spread themselves too thin, you know, five different subjects, that's not good either. But if they focus on the emollients, especially with all these recent things with the military and Barr and everybody, you know, using his golf clubs and things like that, that there's a much better chance of being successful.
Jackie, thanks a lot for the call. So Jackie getting strategic there, saying the emoluments, the appearance of corruption would be the things to pursue, not the fallout from the Mueller report. Heather, what do you think?
Yeah, I think actually she's pretty spot on in what Democrats on the Judiciary Committee are thinking. We talked to them last week, and they've really started talking up the emoluments part of this. And they've even started trying to use words because, you know, if you're just the average person and you hear the word emoluments, like, do you know automatically what that means? I didn't know what that meant until we started reporting on it, right? And so they've started to use, you know, more common sense words to try to explain what they're getting at. Self-dealing is one of them. But really, they're hammering home the corruption angle because they think that that's much easier for folks to digest and understand. And they think that voters would be outraged if they were able to prove that Trump is using his public office, his government service, to profit and benefit himself. And so they're looking at various issues. She mentioned, you know, the military being forced to stay over at his resorts, Vice President Pence staying at one of his hotels in Ireland. But it goes much beyond that. There are allegations that, you know, he was a part of this plan to pay hush money payments to adult film stars who alleged to have affairs with Trump, and that's possible campaign finance violations right before the election and all kinds of things. So they are exploring all of these, but they are really starting to hone in on the corruption angle because they do worry that the Mueller report did not move public sentiment the way that it hoped, and they see a window that's closing for the opportunity to impeach, and they think that corruption and making that clear to the public could help sway sentiment in a way that the Mueller report hasn't so far.
Thanks a lot for that call. Go to Ryan now in Appleton. Ryan, hello.
Hello.
What do you think?
My questions are, it's all a bunch of, and you know, there's no specifics at all. Every time you try to squeeze a Democratic person for their knowledge on Trump, what they should be impeaching him for, they always say, oh, he's just corrupt, because they keep hearing those talking points all the time. So do you have any specifics that they should impeach Trump for? Because I'm sure somebody would want to hear it.
Ryan, thanks a lot for the call. And it sounds like, Heather, that's what you're saying about the Democrats' focus, demonstrable things like the president making money from the Air Force and foreign powers and that being apparently forbidden as the Constitution is written.
Yeah, and I think the problem with Democrats that they've really struggled with is the Mueller report is 450 pages, and they don't really know how to boil that down and make it make sense for the public in a way that is easily digestible. And like I said earlier, there are 10 episodes that Mueller laid out where his team thinks that Trump tried to obstruct justice. And Democrats who want to impeach the president hope to turn that into an article of impeachment against him. But again, they have struggled to have these witnesses who were eyewitnesses to these instances come forward and testify and tell the story in their own words and be on the nightly news, their audio be on the radio, things like that. And because of that, the message really isn't getting through to the public. I think most Democrats know the extent of Trump's corruption in their mind and what they want to pursue, but there are so many different lanes that they feel like they could take and they should take, and they really do have a hard time boiling that down.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller before we move on to a couple other issues in national news. Joan joins us now from Madison. Joan, hi.
Hi. I'm an attorney. I am very concerned about the constitutional balance or imbalance that is going on. It took 2 years to educate the public about the Nixon impeachment, and I believe that's what Jerry Nadler is doing with the inquiry. And I believe that that's how we get the polling up and we get the country educated. And I do believe that's what Nancy Pelosi is waiting for. She's letting the inquiry go because they're going to pull out. Everything comes under the rubric of abuse of power, whether it is obstruction of justice, obstruction of Congress, the emoluments clause, all of it comes under abuse of power. And it's going to take a while. It's going to take all these hearings to educate the public and move the polling data.
Joan, thanks a lot for that call. And Heather, I think Democrats are looking back at the Nixon impeachment and pointing out that early on in that, public opinion didn't favor that at that time either. They're hopeful, I guess, Democrats would be that public opinion will shift.
Yeah, and that's the argument that folks like Jerry Nadler and others who, you know, have supported opening this impeachment investigation for a long time, that's the argument that they make. When you look back at Nixon, public support wasn't on their side until they got through the investigative process, and then, you know, it was overwhelming. I think the issue here, though, is the politics up on the Hill are a lot different than they were back then. Things are a lot more fast-moving. And Democratic leadership is very, very, very reluctant to wade into an impeachment process, particularly on the floor, when we get past the end of this year into the presidential election season, because I think there is a concern for them that even if they do have the votes to impeach the president, the Senate will not convict. And so he will not be removed from office. And then their concern is that President Trump will take that fact and use it to bolster his reelection. And they think that it could actually help benefit him in November 2020. And that, you know, there are other Democrats on the other side of the argument who disagree with that and think this is a moral issue and they should not stand for these alleged abuses of power, et cetera, et cetera. But that's where Democratic leadership is coming from. And they are afraid of helping Trump win the White House again when, you know, they actually want to do the opposite, obviously.
Joan, thanks for that call. Talking to Heather Cagle, congressional reporter for Politico, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Want to move on to one or two more things, Heather. Over the weekend, a couple of oil installations in Saudi Arabia, big ones, bombed by drone attacks. The White House and Saudi Arabia saying Iran ultimately behind it. What are you hearing from members of Congress about the U.S. response here?
Well, Congress is all over the place. The Progressive Caucus in the House put out a statement just a few minutes ago urging Trump to de-escalate tensions with Iran because, you know, earlier this morning he announced he was adding more sanctions. And then you have allies of the president like Lindsey Graham and Tom Cotton, who are hawks in the Senate, and they have argued that the president isn't going far enough and that there needs to be some kind of military intervention. They want to see the president go a lot stronger on this. And Lindsey Graham in particular has been very outspoken and critical of the president, and we talked to him earlier because the president kind of fired back and said, essentially, you don't know what I know, and these sanctions are going a long way. And we talked to Senator Graham earlier, and, you know, he wasn't backing down. He thinks that by not doing some kind of military engagement with Iran, and, you know, there's a broad spectrum of what that could be, that the Iranians will take this as a sign of weakness on part of the United States and continue to disrupt relations in the Middle East. And so Congress is all over the map on this issue right now today.
There'll be a lot to watch for there. And then finally, this week, Manhattan's district attorney's office has subpoenaed an accounting firm for 8 years of President Trump's tax returns. Do we know what investigation this is tied to?
Yeah, it's a state investigation to look at whether Trump or others violated state laws by paying these adult film stars who alleged to have affairs with President Trump before he was president. He denies the affairs, obviously. And we saw his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, plead guilty to participating in this on the federal level. And he's serving, I think, 3 years in prison or so, right? But so this is a state investigation related to the same issue. But it's one of many attempts by, like, New York and congressional Democrats down here to somehow obtain President Trump's tax returns and see if there are, you know, like potential abuses of power that they can prove through those financial documents, because, again, he has refused to release them.
And as you mentioned earlier, this could tie back into what Congress is doing. They're looking at some of these allegations that the New York state legal system is looking at. This could ultimately feed back and help Democrats in Congress if this information comes out.
Yeah, you're right. But I think the important point to make here is this is still in the grand jury process. It's a grand jury investigation. So they're subpoenaing these 8 years of returns. But that information would stay confidential unless there was a criminal trial and it was submitted as evidence, right? So there's no easy way to, and I think Democrats on the Hill who are in court separately trying, battling Trump to get his tax returns have realized there is no easy way to obtain the president's sensitive financial documents, and he is going to do everything he can in every arena, New York, D.C., California, to fight efforts to get those documents.
Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Heather Cagle is a congressional reporter for Politico. She joins today for our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. You can still join in with your thoughts on the idea of impeachment. Should House Democrats pursue it or not? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you think. It's that time of year again. Halloween decorations are already popping up in stores, and candy companies are announcing their weird flavors for all the holidays, including a candy cane maker announcing this year's new flavors, including those shock value ones that they use to get their name in the news. I won't name the company, but their flavors, kale-flavored candy canes, pizza-flavored, and ham, a.k.a. the Hamdy cane. J. Carlisle Larson, Central Time producer, in here with me now. Hey, J.C.
Hello.
So would you try any of these flavors, kale, pizza, or ham-flavored candy canes?
So it's going to be a hard pass on the pizza-flavored
fair,
one, which I think is probably going to taste terrible. A little intrigued by the kale flavor. I don't know why, but I feel like it might be weirdly okay. Can't guarantee it, but I'd still try it.
It's bitter.
Yes.
And it wouldn't have that distinctive kale crunch. I guess candy canes are crunchy. Now, do you have candies where you're like the one person who likes them and everybody else hates them and you by extension
and me.
Or vice versa?
Personal. Yeah, I'm enraged right now. No, there are a couple that I like. I really like those really trashy peanut butter candy ones with the orange and black wrappers, which
and they're really weirdly chewy.
Yeah,
okay,
love
gross.
Those. And I also really like salty black licorice, which is big in Europe. I'm not a snob. No one likes it except for maybe Tim in our office. But I love the saltier, the more bitter, the better.
This is Central Time.